I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
Shell Shock, a professor who studies political violence, says he's concerned about the recent shootings across the United States, not just because they've been deadly, of course, but because the way the perpetrators appear to be getting their message out even after those shootings.
And usually when a property listing includes the words as is, you might want to look elsewhere. But if you're bidding on real estate in Coombs, British Columbia, it could also mean you'll be the owner of hundreds of live butterflies from around the world.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
You are tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit KAXE.org. And we receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. After Dark is KAXE Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, hip-hop, and more. This week's hosts, Ken McBride and Mark Hicks, will be playing rockabilly. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. I'm going to play a song for you. This is a new one from Curtis Harding called Running Out of Space. that's Curtis Harding with Running Out of Space.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a charged situation. Former FBI Director James Comey is indicted for allegedly lying to Congress. Our guest says when it comes to political interference by the Trump administration, the case is already setting a dangerous precedent.
Bullet points. Bullets with inscriptions seem to keep showing up at shootings in the U.S. as an often cryptic kind of manifesto. But as the messages get coverage, our guest worries it's giving other shooters more ammunition.
Dozens of delegates walked out en masse as the Israeli Prime Minister addressed the UN General Assembly today, and Benjamin Netanyahu had much to say about the countries, including Canada, that recognized Palestinian statehood this week.
Try again. It's do or die for Canada at the finals of the Women's Rugby World Cup. A Canadian Olympic medalist says tomorrow will be the country's best chance to show it can beat the dominant England team after a string of losses.
Waiting in the wings, when she first bought a butterfly sanctuary on Vancouver Island, our guest was winging it. But nearly a decade later now, she says she has loved every minute and is looking for a new owner to take over.
And Soul Air. An 80-year-old Nashville man tells us about his storied barefoot runs and what it means to have his grandson join him. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that wouldn't want to be in their shoes, you know, if they wore them. James Comey is maintaining his innocence today and says he welcomes a trial. In her indictment of the former FBI director, U.S. Attorney Lindsay Halligan accuses him of making false statements to Congress and obstructing justice. Ms. Halligan was recently appointed to the Eastern District of Virginia by President Donald Trump after he called for Mr. Comey and other perceived opponents of his to be criminally prosecuted and forced her predecessor to resign. In a video on social media, James Comey said he's not surprised to have become her first target.
My family and I have known for years that there are costs to standing up to Donald Trump. But we couldn't imagine ourselves living any other way. We will not live on our knees, and you shouldn't either. My heart is broken for the Department of Justice, but I have great confidence in the federal judicial system, and I'm innocent. So let's have a trial.
Former FBI Director James Comey reacting to the news of his indictment yesterday. Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan who stepped down in March 2017 in the face of multiple other Trump firings. We reached her in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Barbara McQuaid, as you well know, the U.S. president has made no secret of his desire to see James Comey prosecuted. So are you surprised at all that this is where we're at today?
I really am. That's because the case itself seems so flimsy based on the evidence and the fact that the president is calling for the prosecution of someone else made me think it was very unlikely for it to happen. We saw this repeatedly during President Trump's first term, and prosecutors wisely, in my opinion, refrained from taking the bait and doing his bidding. So I have to say, maybe I've just spent too many years working inside the Justice Department. I am surprised to see it come to fruition.
Why do you think it has come to this point this time? Because as you said, he's wanted charges brought against a whole list of other people. Why this time?
President Trump's second term is very different from his first. During his first term, he appointed to high-level positions people who had experience and expertise in their field. And I think as a result, they sometimes served as a check on his worst instincts. They were willing to tell him no. This time around, I think he has perhaps learned from what he perceived to be his mistakes and is appointing instead people who are light on experience and expertise, but heavy on loyalty. And so, for example, we just saw in this district where this indictment of James Comey occurred, the firing of his own appointee, a U.S. attorney who, by all accounts, had great experience and expertise and professionalism. He was fired when he refused to indict James Comey. He was immediately replaced with Trump's former personal lawyer and a White House aide who came in, and she was willing to file this indictment. And so I think what we are seeing now is loyalists willing to do Trump's bidding in a way that we haven't before. And I think it makes this moment a very dangerous one for American democracy.
Let's look at the case itself. He's charged, the former FBI director James Comey is charged with obstruction of justice and making false statements to Congress. What is he accused of lying about?
Well, he testified in 2017 that he was not the source of any unauthorized leaks to the press. In 2020, 3 years later, it was pointed out to him that his deputy, a man named Andrew McCabe, had testified that Comey had authorized McCabe to leak to the press. When Comey was asked about that apparent contradiction, he said, "I stand by my statement from 2017. So this goes back 8 years, a statement, and the only apparent evidence for it is that it conflicts with the testimony of another witness. Now, maybe there's more evidence that is unknown to me, but that appears to be it. And in fact, in the meantime, the Department of Justice Inspector General conducted an investigation into the same matter and concluded that Jim Comey did not authorize any leaks. And so based on what we know publicly, the evidence seems not just thin, but contradictory to the claims alleged in the indictment.
It was issued, this indictment, by a grand jury, as you know, and while the jury rejected a third count of making false statements, you know, they reviewed evidence and determined this case should proceed. Is it possible that they know something that you and that we don't know?
Yes, that's absolutely possible. So I think until we see what the evidence is, we probably need to withhold judgment, but also keep in mind that when a case is presented to a grand jury, they hear only one side of the case. There is no defense attorney present. There is no cross-examination of witnesses. And so, you know, based on what we know, it seems weak. But of course, as you point out, we won't know that until we see the trial.
Donald Trump, as we've discussed, has singled out others. New York Attorney General Letitia James, California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff, you know, pushing for charges against them, for them to be prosecuted. Do you think that now that this line has been crossed, that other political opponents will be facing this as well?
I think it's definitely a possibility. So in this district, the Eastern District of Virginia, where the case is being investigated against Letitia James, I think it would not surprise me to see this same prosecutor go forward. In both of those instances, what we know from the public reporting is that each of them made a statement on mortgage documents identifying more than one property as their primary residence. That's a red flag for prosecutors, but it is hardly proof of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. To say they must be prosecuted on this basis, again, there's reporting that the fired U.S. attorney in Virginia declined to prosecute Letitia James, but we may see that there is somebody willing to do that to fulfill their career ambitions or their Donald Trump's political agenda.
Comey has said he is welcoming this trial and is, quote, keeping the faith. Are you at this point?
I think if anybody is prepared to meet this moment, it's Jim Comey. You know, he has managed to become a very unpopular figure in American politics from members of both the left and the right, but I don't think anyone has ever doubted his integrity. And I think that if anybody's prepared to take this on, it's him. He used to be the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. He has hired as his lawyer the former U.S. attorney from the Chicago area, another outstanding lawyer who is his good friend. The two of them are going to make a very formidable opponent for the U.S. attorney, former White House aide, who is now taking on this case.
And just finally, Barbara, what should the American people do, in your view, if this, you know, you talked about how upsetting and concerning this moment is for you, given your experience, but what can the American people who disagree with this actually do?
Well, we have a lot of things in our power. We can protest. We can write letters to the editor. We can contact our members of Congress. We can post on social media. We have the ability to vote. We can serve on juries. And when we see cases that we don't think has evidence to stand up to the charges, we can return verdicts of not guilty. So we all have a power, the power in a democracy, as long as we have the courage to use it.
Barbara McQuaid, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney and a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. We reached her in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For Canada's national rugby team, it's quite simply the biggest game of their lives. Tomorrow, the team will take to the field in London, UK, trying to become Women's World Cup champions for the first time. It's not going to be easy. Trying to stop them is a dominant England team known as the Red Roses, and they'll be playing against a deafening hometown crowd of some 80,000 people. Canada beat the six-time champion, the New Zealand Black Ferns, to make the final. Charity Williams is an Olympic silver medal-winning rugby player and best friend of current Team Canada player Asia Hogan-Rochester. We reached her in Vancouver.
Charity, I hear, was pretty emotional to watch Canada's team win against New Zealand in the semis. Take us to that moment, what it was like for you.
It was just amazing. I watched it with the team that I'm playing with now, which is UBC Women's Rugby. And I watched it with two of my teammates who were with me in Paris, Piper Logan and Sheila Venezuela. And we just, like, throughout the game, it was just so inspiring. But there was a moment where we kind of all looked at each other and it was like, it just brought us back to that semifinal against Australia in Paris last year. And the three of us just got so emotional.
Cheers and tears in those moments?
Yeah, there was tears. There was a lot of hugging. We were just like so kind of overwhelmed with emotion. And I think like there was this one moment where we all just like the three of us looked at each other and we just kind of knew like how amazing like this moment is. When the final whistle blew, even though like we knew that they had had the game, when that final whistle blew, we were just like cheering and screaming and jumping and hugging, and it was just such a beautiful moment for the three of us, and also just to share that with like the young UBC team.
Your best friend is on the team, Asia Hogan-Rochester. Were you texting them right after?
Yes, I sent a flurry of text messages as soon as that whistle blew, and just expressing just how proud I am and how impressed I am with their game and how much they've grown over the last like you know few years, and just like you know you just started in a World Cup semifinal and you scored and you helped the team succeed in that win. So I was just so impressed and I'm just really excited for them this weekend.
How do you think the team has been preparing for what they're about to face? Because you're certainly no stranger to high pressure situations, do or die scenarios. But we're talking about 82,000 cheering fans, a very popular and dominant Red Roses team for England. So how are they going to be preparing for that?
At this point, they've done everything that, you know, they could possibly do. I think they've been preparing for the last 2 years, just putting out, you know, top performances against some of the best teams in the world and coming into this World Cup as the second ranked team. I think they've done everything they could do. And I think right now it's just about fine tuning and, you know, playing in front of 80,000 people is insane. Like, yeah, at that point, you can't hear anything on the pitch, and it's all just about, you know, doing the things that you do in training under pressure on the pitch and just staying connected with your team. We played in front of 60,000 people in Paris and they were all rooting against us, and so I know at least a few of my teammates who played in Paris who were on the World Cup team know what that is like. Mm-hmm. And the other girls have so much experience. And honestly, when someone's cheering against you, it really just fuels you. And, you know, we don't have any of the pressure. All the pressure's on the other team. For us, it's just, you know, we show up and get our job done.
How are you feeling about what this has meant to the sport? The inspiration for younger players, women in particular, who are watching where this sport, how far this sport has come.
I just feel so inspired, and I feel really lucky to have been a player in the game, improving this game, but also just to be here to watch, like, you know, this team make history. I think, like, I think it's such an honor, even now when I'm watching the game with these young UBC players, like for them, when they're watching it, like they're thinking like, oh, like this could be me in 4 years. Like they're watching Florence run these crazy lines and they're like, they're taking notes and trying to figure out how they can run these lines. They're watching Asia stiff arm on the sideline and they're literally taking notes and trying to be like these players, trying to carve their own name through them. So I think it's just, it's really special. The game has grown so much. And one of the craziest things is that, you know, a lot of people think that Canada is the underdog and you know, it's crazy that they'd be in a gold medal match. But I mean, we've been a top three team for a very, very long time. And I'm just so happy that finally the whole world is catching on to, you know, who we are in rugby.
Have you seen young girls get into the sport more than in the past?
Yeah, definitely. Like even since our experience in Paris, it's just I've been flooded with messages from parents of, you know, my daughter or my son watched you guys play and they were so inspired and, you know, they got some boots. Even my nephew has started playing rugby and I'm really grateful to be a part of that story. And yeah,
you've got plans to watch tomorrow. Will there be a little party happening?
Yes, there is a party. We are getting after it at 8 a.m., the whole UBC team and whoever else nice. Wants to join us at SI. And we're going to watch the game. And immediately after that, we're going to go hit our own warm-up for our own game at 1 p.m. So hoping to be motivated to win
so.
That game.
And tell our listeners what SI is. This is on campus?
Yeah, it's a Sports Illustrated Clubhouse. Mm. It's a bar and restaurant on UBC campus. So 8 a.m. if anybody wants to join.
I think that popped up after I was a student there.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to text Asia before the match? What do you think
they'll
say?
Yes, I will. Kind of what I say every time, like, you know, I'm really proud of you and I love them and that's it. Like, just go out there and do what you know how to do. I actually just spoke to them a bit earlier, and you know, it's there's the general nerves that anyone would have going into a final, but it's you know, it's really just like you've done everything you could possibly do. You've already at, you know, your debut in the World Cup have carved a name for yourself in Canadian rugby and international rugby. So it's just about, you know, having fun at the end. The last thing I said was, you know, good luck and have fun. You're like, yep, I'm going to have some fun. I was like, okay, I'll see you in a week.
Charity, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for this. And you have fun tomorrow too. Good luck in your match.
Thank you.
We reached Charity Williams in Vancouver. And if you'd like to tune in to the finals, kickoff tomorrow is at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Across Canada, tens of thousands of Canada Post workers are on strike, and they're not the only ones unhappy about changes that could be coming to the way Canadians get their mail. The federal government has cleared the way for Canada Post to end home delivery completely and close some rural post offices. The changes are an attempt to tackle Canada Post's struggling finances. The Crown Corporation lost more than $1 billion last year alone, with bigger losses expected this year. Lori Hoddenott is the mayor of McNab Brayside, a rural township west of Ottawa. She told CBC Ottawa that the decision means seniors in her community may have to drive long distances on winter roads just to get their mail.
The established community mailboxes that are in play right now are within the villages, such as the village of White Lake, the village of Brayside. 60% of our land base, if not more, are agricultural working farms, and they're large ones. So we're very spread out. And the bulk of our residents are farmers, and the majority are elder farmers. So the first concern that comes to mind with the suspension of home delivery is how far are these seniors and rural residents going to have to drive on a rural road in the dead of winter? And how often are they going to do it? The other thing with a rural community, we do not have municipal transit. So it's not like they have options. It's either get yourself to the mailbox or you're not going. Then we do share, have an available taxi service in the next town. But pretty much the rule of thumb is they won't go down farm laneways in the winter. So the seniors, especially with a time-sensitive mail, medical results, some medications are done on home delivery. Farm operations rely heavily on Canada Post for timely deliveries. If it's on the senior to get down the laneway and go 15 kilometers up a rural winter road to get to the mail, they're not going to do it every day. The first big question I'm going to have for Canada Post is, how close together are you going to put these things? How many kilometers are our residents going to have to drive? It's not just about getting mail. When you're rural, the post office is a community hub. And that's where people go. And while they're standing in line, they're chatting and they're catching up on the news. There's a community bulletin board. You know, it's part of the social life of people. The decision makers in the feds who made this decision, there wasn't any outreach that I'm aware of. We weren't looped in for conversation ahead of time. So they will be hearing from me.
That was Lori Hodnott, the mayor of McNab Brayside near Ottawa. For years, Nashville has borne witness to a striking sight, an 80-year-old man running barefoot through the streets, rain or shine. Jerry Barber was running for the pure joy of it. This past weekend, though, Mr. Barber didn't lace up for a new reason, a race to benefit the Ronald McDonald House. And he wasn't running alone. His grandson, Braden, joined him, also barefoot, carrying on the family tradition. We reached them in Gallatin, Tennessee, and Franklin, Tennessee, respectively.
Jerry, I know it's been a few days now since the run. How are your feet doing?
Oh, doing great.
You're used to this. How long does it take to heal at this point?
Oh, it doesn't heal. It stays good. As of this morning, I've got 7,143 miles on my feet, so they're in good shape.
They're in good shape. You're in good shape. Do you soak them or anything when you get back after a race like that?
Oh, no. I wash them twice. People
sure.
tell me, don't your feet get dirty? And I said, sure, I wash them twice every time I run. How often do you wash your shoes? No, they're in good shape.
This is not something that people do or see every day, though I have had an interview about this, which we'll get to in a minute, in the past. But what was the moment that you decided that this is something you wanted to do, that you wanted to run and you wanted to run barefoot?
It was the fall of 2009. I read a blog post on running barefooted. I've been running 56 years. Mm-hmm. But as I read that, I thought that felt good when I was 5 years old. Every spring, I'd start running and playing barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
And if it felt good at five, why wouldn't it at 65? I read three books during the winter and started toughening up in March and ran the Franklin 10K on Labor Day of that year.
And Braden, what did you think? Let's bring you in now. When your grandfather, you know, you've known him to run all this time, and then he says, I'm going to run barefoot now. What did you think?
You know, what's funny is I don't even remember exactly when he started. It never was like, oh, wow, he's running barefoot. It was just, he's always got fun ideas and does things a little differently. And so it was just normal that he was doing it to me. I mean, it was a change for him, but I'm like, okay, yeah, that's just granddaddy.
did it take a lot of convincing, Braden, because you don't run barefoot, but you could have run the race with your grandfather with shoes on, but you chose
right.
not to. Who did you decide to do that?
Yeah, I decided that I was going to run the race with him. And then I thought, you know, it'd be a fun surprise if I could just do this with him barefoot, do it in his style. And so, you know, I feel like that would be a more meaningful thing to be able to have that kind of connection. Because, you know, anyone there that's running is going to be running with shoes. And if I'm running by a side, I might as well look like him. So I just wanted to surprise him in that way.
I guess I should ask you how your feet are doing, because you're not used to this.
Yeah, you know, I'll say my feet feel better than ever. Oh. It took a little bit to warm up to it. You know, I got some calluses and some blisters and some torn skin here and there as I was building up to that. Mm-hmm. But now, since I've been doing it for a couple months now, they feel great.
Are you a convert? Are you only going to run like this now?
Who knows? You know, his rule is if it's 50 degrees and above, he does it. So I haven't got to my first winter yet, but we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Gentlemen, I'll play for you a clip of Joseph DeRuvo Jr. From 2023. He was on our program. He does this, but he walks everywhere barefoot, even in the winter.
It's a disciplined movement. I mean, it doesn't allow you to be absent-minded. When you're walking around, you have to be conscious where you're stepping and where you're placing your foot and how you're rolling off your foot.
Jerry, does that strike a chord with you? Can you relate to what he's saying there, that connection?
Yeah, one of the things of barefoot running is that you listen to your body, and if you're running a certain way and it hurts, you do it differently, which is a pretty good philosophy for life.
But you only do it in certain temperatures. Would you switch to every day, all day, walking, running, barefoot?
No. I'm a preacher and, you know, I visit hospitals. I don't want to draw undue attention to myself.
Understood. What did you think when Braden said or surprised you with the no shoes at the charity race?
That was a treat. That was Labor Day, the Franklin Classic in Franklin, Tennessee. I've done it for 26 years. And he told me he was running. And the night before, his mother told me he was going to have red shirt and red pants on. I run in red shirt, red pants, red hat. And I knew that. But then when I saw him without any shoes, I was surprised and touched by what he did.
What do people say when you're out just jogging barefoot? Or are they used to you by now?
That is a story. One of the two most memorable conversations in my life was one morning 2 years ago. A lady was parked in a turning lane. She motioned me to come to her car, and she asked me four questions. Sir, do you know where you're going? Are you lost? Does anybody know where you are? And do you need a ride?
I mean, she was looking out for you.
She was.
Which is touching. But what did you say?
Well, I answered her questions, and I thought I had her converted, and so I kept running a quarter mile. She had turned around, and she was following to see if I turned in my subdivision where I said I was.
Braden, I wonder for you, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to be able, you know, when we're in a position where our grandparents are still with us and such active parts of our lives, and you're doing these things together. What is it like for you to have Jerry as your grandpa?
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of many special things about him being my granddad. But I've learned so much from him, but a lot about being intentional and about relationships and taking care of and managing relationships well. And so I just really want to make the most of every moment that I have with him, because I know it is a blessing to still have grandparents who are alive. And so I don't want to take any moment for granted.
Well, Jerry, Braden, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Yes, Neil, thank you so much for having us.
Take care, gentlemen.
Barefoot runners Jerry Barber and Braden Parsons. They were both in Tennessee.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll look at one of the troubling elements of the recent cases of political violence in the United States, those messages reportedly etched on bullet casings used in the crimes.
And a tourist attraction on Vancouver Island goes up for sale, giving us a chance to focus on something beautiful in a beautiful part of the world. Stay tuned. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens. As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer hosts, Ashley and Ryan. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. McCroskey Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the new exhibit Unearthed, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed media show developed from foraged objects. And we receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE.
This week, another targeted shooting sent a jolt of fear and speculation through the United States. In Dallas, a sniper opened fire on an immigration facility, killing one detainee and critically injuring two. And once again, authorities drew attention to messages they said were scrawled onto bullet casings used in the attack. In this case, they said one message read, "Anti-ICE." It's just the latest case where an alleged shooter has used ammunition to quite literally send a message. Matthew Crane is a political science professor at the College of Worcester. We reached him in Worcester, Ohio.
Professor, most of these attacks have been deadly. The perpetrators have already killed people. So what is the point of these kinds of messages on these casings?
Well, in some cases, it's too early to tell. We always want to avoid jumping to conclusions only a day or so or a couple of days after an attack till there's a full investigation. But people don't do this by accident. There's always a motivation behind it. And it could be that they're trying to get their point across, their message out. Some people might engage in violence and have a manifesto that they want people to read. Well, the news has gotten a lot better at not giving that platform to people who engage in violence, but it's a lot harder to ignore something like a shell casing of a bullet with an engraving that speaks directly to their message or to their ideology.
It's just interesting that they don't think that the killings themselves are message enough.
Unfortunately, people can read into a killing and spin that in a way that puts forward whatever message they're interested in. The engraving your message or something related to your ideology in a gun or in a shell casing makes that abundantly clear. It really gives the person who's engaged in violence control of the narrative, makes it a lot harder for somebody to ascribe a different motivation to it.
I think for a lot of our listeners, this is something that they started to hear more about, these reports of messages, even sort of hashtag-like language reportedly on casings after the murder of Charlie Kirk, the murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. But if we look back, there actually have been more examples in recent years of this kind of messaging. How far back does this go?
Well, people who have engaged in political violence, political assassinations, have gotten their message out in a variety of ways. Maybe not engraving in a shell casing or on a gun, but just off the top of my head, when John Wilkes Booth assassinated Abraham Lincoln, as he was jumping from the stage from the balcony into the stage, yelled "Sic Semper Tyrannis." Calling death to tyrants, to make it really clear why Lincoln had been assassinated. And so people who engage in acts of political violence are pretty interested in getting their motivations out one way or the other. Because of the very clear and succinct messaging of engraving something in a gun or a shell casing, that's something that's probably more likely to get picked up by the media, especially in the digital age. And it's more easily shareable. There might be, as we saw recently, images of the shell casings that then go viral. So you know, that's a much more recent phenomenon, mm-hmm. but trying to really control that message, that's something that's been going on for a while.
On the issue of the kind of coverage these stories gets now, or the sharing of those images, I'm glad you raised that as well, because I wanted to ask you, in terms of the shooting at the ICE facility in Dallas, it was the FBI director, Kash Patel, who shared on social media the image of ammunition allegedly belonging to the shooter in that case, with an anti-ICE message. What signal does that send to you when someone in that position does that?
Well, it makes me worried. So there are two things that really worry me about that situation and situations like it. The first is, the more publicity whoever shares that information, the more publicity this particular approach or method gets, the more likely it's going to be copied. But speaking to your question, my second concern is that when those messages are easily shareable and are able to be tied to a set of ideas, I also worry that governments or other actors then have the ability to tie anyone who has something related to those ideas to violence, right? So in the aftermath of the Dallas shooting, by tweeting out a picture of the shell casing that said anti-ICE, it gives the U.S. government yet another excuse to tie anyone who might oppose the U.S. policies regarding immigration or detention of immigrants or deportation or concerns about the way ICE and other agencies have been enforcing that, to tie them to violence, when in fact, of course, a large majority of people who might share those views might be protesting or writing to their congresspeople or engaging in more nonviolent forms of dissent. So that, to me, I don't want to read into the intent of the FBI director or the administration, but that does worry me. And it's consistent, unfortunately, with a lot of the signals the administration's been sending over the last couple of days.
And looking back at the Charlie Kirk assassination, in that case, the ammunition was reportedly engraved with messages that seemed to be related to gaming and memes. And that alone was difficult for people to understand. But also, you know, the fact that this was such a horrific crime, and then this kind of messaging is hard for people to get their heads around.
Absolutely. And some of that might have to be with the more nihilistic culture of some of the online and gaming communities and the rhetoric that gets thrown around. Again, I'm not an expert on that. I'll leave that to the experts. But, of course, I know that's been bandied about as a possibility. One of the things that concerns me as somebody who studies political violence is that when that kind of sort of offhand language is used, it makes it seem less impactful and less frightening than it really is, and maybe creates a permission structure for others to engage in that behavior. So the language involved is important, and it does make me concerned.
Well, Professor, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Matthew Crane is a political science professor at the College of Worcester. We reached him in Worcester, Ohio. As Benjamin Netanyahu took the stage at the United Nations today, more than 100 diplomats from more than 50 countries used the opportunity to walk out, according to a tally by the Washington Post. Canada's delegation was among those that remained, as the Israeli Prime Minister delivered his speech to a very empty-looking room. Here is some of what he said about the 157 out of 193 UN member states now recognizing the state of Palestine.
What you're doing is giving the ultimate reward to intolerant fanatics who perpetrated and supported the October 7th massacre. Giving the Palestinians a state 1 mile from Jerusalem after October 7th is like giving Al-Qaeda a state 1 mile from New York City after September 11th. This is sheer madness. It's insane, and we won't do it. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks to special efforts by Israeli intelligence, my words are now also being carried. They're streamed live to the cell phones of Gazans. So to the remaining Hamas leaders and to the jailers of our hostages, I now say, lay down your arms. Let my people go. Free the hostages, all of them, the whole 48. Free the hostages now. The final remnants of Hamas are holed up in Gaza City. They vow to repeat the atrocities of October 7th again and again and again, no matter how diminished their forces. That is why Israel must finish the job. That is why we want to do so as fast as possible.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking today at the United Nations General Assembly. Usually, when a real estate listing describes a potential purchase as a unique opportunity, it feels suspicious. It's one of those euphemisms like cozy, character, or full of potential that often serve as red flags. But in the case of one Vancouver Island property, unique really fits the bill. Butterfly World is a tourist attraction in Coombs, BC, on Vancouver Island, and its owner, Sheree Rains, is selling. We reached Ms. Rains in Coombs.
Sheree, if we were to drive up to your property, what would we find?
Butterfly World sits on 18 acres, so it's a long, slightly windy driveway. Mm-hmm. The trees are all really well established, having been in business for 35 years. There are beautiful specimen trees around the entire property. There's a maple garden. There's sequoia trees, cottonwoods and cedars. It's very green and lush and beautiful.
Yeah, it does sound very beautiful. And yeah, that's just even before we see a single butterfly.
That's inside the butterfly greenhouse, exactly.
Yeah, and then you'd step into one of those two greenhouses. So as you said, Butterfly World has been there for a long time. You've owned it for the last 9 years. Why did you want to take this on?
I didn't actually put a whole lot of thought into why. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time with a 2- and 5-year-old, and I was ready to get back into work. And I've worked in horticulture. I've always had a love of nature and plants and beautiful things. And I just felt like it was somewhere where I could put all of my skills and passions into one place, and that's kind of how it worked out.
And how many butterflies are there in those greenhouses? I can only imagine what it's like to step inside.
We try to have a full greenhouse, so there's quite an impact for customers coming in. Sometimes customers are complaining that they're getting dive-bombed by the blue morpho butterflies, but that's a good thing. That was my whole goal from the start. So we get shipments over 500 butterflies every 2 weeks. Mm. A lot of people don't know that butterflies have a really short lifespan. Mm. In the adult stage as a butterfly, it's only about 2 weeks. So we get shipments over 500 every 2 weeks from all over South America and Southeast Asia. So we try to have approximately 300 butterflies in flight on any given day, with approximately 20 different species, with a good mix of different varieties, sizes, and colors, for people to come in and have their magical butterfly experience.
Is it as magical caring for them, though?
Yes, it is. Even after 9 years of doing it, like, we close for the winter months. Yeah. But every spring, when we get our first shipment in early March, getting ready for our opening, I'm always excited to see the butterflies again. and I always miss them when they're gone. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's an amazing experience. We get into new species from different times or from time to time as well. So that's extremely exciting. We get a new species in that we've never seen before in our lives. We have butterflies that do full cycles within the greenhouse. So if we have their host plant, they are laying eggs. The eggs are hatching. We see the caterpillars grow into their chrysalis and emerging in the greenhouse and doing a full cycle through there as well. So that's pretty exciting as well. It's been a wonderful time.
Your children are older now, but I mean, what a way to grow up. Did they think that they lived in an enchanted forest or something?
Well, my younger son could care less. And my older son, he did get involved with the business a bit. He started training in there when he was 10 years old, and he could do cash and customers, no problem. So he gained some work skills. He tend to like the birds more. We have tropical zebra finches in there. So, yeah, my kids have enjoyed it. I think we're all ready for our next chapter in life. Yeah. But I'm excited to see it continue to grow in the community. It's been a huge landmark, I think, in the community.
So who is the ideal buyer, in your view? What would make a good butterfly conservatory owner?
I would say anybody that just has a passion to make things better. Somebody who has an eye for detail, who enjoys connecting with people on a personal level and creating environments where people can experience joy and happiness. Education is also a huge point in it. We get all the school groups that come through, seniors groups, indigenous groups, and special needs groups that come through. So it's really important for somebody who wants to have good human connection with people. We've met so many wonderful people. I've made best friends out of some of our customers or staff. A real community engagement, somebody who wants to be involved in supporting different fundraisers in the community. We have educational programs and different fundraisers where we help certain families in need. I didn't have any butterfly experience when I took over the business. It was all self-taught. It was a huge learning curve, but it was in a massive undertaking. But I have learned so much, and I've grown so much personally and professionally. And like I said, built amazing connections over the years with some amazing people and my staff, all the customers. So
what have you learned about what goes into their care that you would pass on?
It's just about the temperature, humidity, and heat control.
Paying attention.
There's multiple different levels, but it's pretty basic. And I think if anything, it's a bit of a juggling act, but most importantly, I think as most people know, like, we can't really control nature. We can just do our best to try to support it. And that's what we've done in the Butterfly World Conservatory, is created a natural environment for the butterflies to thrive and live out their lives within the greenhouse.
What's your favorite butterfly?
The Caligo atreus. It's a magnificent owl from South America.
Mm-hmm. Why do you like that one?
When I took over the business, they were in the greenhouse, and they are a larger butterfly. They kind of have a bit of a nocturnal presence and more active at dusk and dawn. The outer wing is kind of a tiger marbling with a ivory band on the outside and a distinct owl eye marking, which is like a bright yellow eye. And the inner wing is bright purple and mango orange. It flashes its colors as it flies through. They're pretty chill. They sit around a lot more. They're not as active as some of the other butterflies, so you can admire them a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does.
I think
sound...
I just built a connection with that species at the start because they were in there the longest from when I took over in 2017. And they stayed right through till the end of the season because they had reproduced naturally within the greenhouse. Mm. So I felt like they were my friends at the time.
Sheree, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sheree Rains is the owner of Butterfly World in Coombs, BC. That's where we reached her. driving around downtown Fernie, British Columbia at lunchtime on Tuesday, you might have noticed a long line outside Polar Peak Books and Treasures. Those weren't customers waiting to get inside. They were volunteers there to help the store move out. Over the course of about 20 minutes, they stood side by side and passed hundreds of books from the old store to the new store nearby. Here's co-owner Melody Janot describing to the CBC this morning how it all came about.
We were inspired by a bookstore in Australia who did something very similar. And we had a lot of books to move. And we also had a lot of offers from the community to help us. And so we were inspired by both and just threw it out on social media that at noon on Tuesday, we were going to be moving the bookstore and handing books one at a time if anyone was interested in joining us. Not really sure, Chris, if anyone would show up.
Okay. And how far are we talking about here? Where is your new location compared to your old location?
It's really just a block away. We did have to cross a street, but it's not very far, which sometimes makes a move harder, we've realized, as opposed to loading up a truck and moving it somewhere far. And no better way than to hand a book person to person to get it just down the block and from a shelf to a shelf.
Okay, so you put it out on social media that you wanted to try this on a Tuesday. What happened? How many people showed up?
Well, we didn't get an exact count, but we're estimating it was about 150 people.
Whoa.
And really, I know, representation from really every corner of the community. We had students from a school across the street with their teachers. We had friends. We had loyal customers. We had fellow business owners from around the community just pouring into the street just minutes before we were ready to start. And you asked the question about logistics. We weren't really sure. And so what we did was just started to line everybody up. Got a few folks organized to get us across the street, and then we just started passing books.
You just started passing books. Did you pass books in any kind of order, or was just the first book you could grab went along the chain? And then what happened at the other end of the chain when the books were dropped off?
Yeah, so we were just a titch organized enough to have books ready. And what we did is we had one of the original bookstore owners kick us off with the very first book. And it was quite symbolic. It's a book that her husband has written about trees, Terry Nelson. And the book was written right around the time that a tree had fallen on their property. And they used the wood from that tree to build some of the first bookshelves in the original store. And so that was the first book that was passed by Laura Nelson to me. And then I passed it to the crowd, and they got it all the way down the block to the new location that I'm in right now, to my co-owner, Maureen, and she put it on the bookshelf here. So it was both fun and symbolic of the legacy of the store in the community.
That's Melanie Janot, the co-owner of Polar Peak Books and Treasures in Fernie, BC, speaking with the CBC's Chris Walker, host of Daybreak South.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard right across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Brin Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Cooks. I'll take care.